Dr. Greer, you've been doing research over the years with people who have problems with stopping breathing. What is the concern?
Okay, so typically after surgery, or if someone is in chronic pain with cancer or so forth, the most effective painkiller are opiates, such as morphine. And morphine goes into the system and it shuts off nerve cells that transmit pain, and that's what you're after. But it also binds to the part of the brain that generates the drive to breathe. And those neurons, or those nerve cells, are kind of like the pacemaker cells that keep your heart going. They keep the rhythm going for breathing. And they get shut down by the opiates. And some people, it's not too severe. In 15 or 20% of the people, it's so severe that they have to be artificially ventilated after taking the opiates. And then they may have to withdraw the opiates so they don't get the full pain killing that they're after, just to maintain their breathing. And another problem is with newborns. When newborns are going through procedures that involve, that induce pain, they usually hit them pretty hard with opiates because it's difficult to get feedback about how much pain they're in. These are quite often premature newborns. And then they ventilate them. And you really don't want to ventilate newborn babies if you don't have to, because their lungs are so fragile. So we've know a lot about where the breathing rhythm is generated in the brain. We know there's a small group of cells that are responsible for this, and we know that opiates shut those cells off, or at least in some people, they just slow them down so you don't breathe as fast. We also learned about which neurochemicals in the brain are normally there that keep the rhythm going. And we found out over the years that there's one particular receptor, it's called the AMPA receptor. It's the most common receptor in the brain for neurotransmission. Anyway, the AMPA receptor, if you stop that, if you block that, then all breathing would stop. So we came across this class of drugs called ampakines. And ampakines bind to this AMPA receptor and make it more effective. You get more bang for your buck at each time an AMPA receptor is activated, if the ampakine is around.
And what was that drug being used for?
So I actually read about this drug in the newspaper, I think it was the Globe and Mail, over breakfast, and ampakines were developed, and they were trying them for Alzheimer's disease and attention disorder, and they were this so-called smart pill drugs. They thought that they would increase one's memory. And in the particular study I was reading about in the newspaper, they had some pilots who were sleep-deprived, and they had them play these video games and showed that their skills deteriorated as they were deprived. And then they gave them an ampakine, and it made them more alert. And this was a promising approach for this drug. Now, I went and read about ampakines because I was working on AMPA receptors, and it clicked that these ampakines would juice up the normal activity that's going on in this critical part of the brain for breathing. So I hypothesized that, okay, if this part of the brain is being suppressed by opiates and also by anesthetics, what if we gave the ampakine to bring it back up to a level where it keeps going? So I tried this, and indeed it worked beautifully. We could give as much painkiller that would be normally lethal, and then intervene with an injection of ampakine, and within 30 seconds the breathing comes back. We could also mix opiates at a very high dose with the ampakine, administer it, and the breathing was not suppressed, but they had total painkilling, total analgesia, which is the critical part. It wouldn't be any good to bring the breathing back if you had lost the analgesia, but that didn't happen. So from there, once that worked, the company in California that made ampakines called Cortex Pharmaceuticals, they became very interested and wanted to, we had a patent on this novel use and they wanted to develop that. And then we found a fellow in Germany who could perform a clinical trial quickly. And he took 20 volunteers, their medical students, and he gave them enough opiate, morphine, to suppress their breathing by about half. So the breathing went about half as fast as normal. And of course, the morphine got rid of any pain sensation they would have from, for instance, applying an electrical shock to their fingers. And then they repeated the same experiment with the same individuals, but gave them an ampakine as well. And then their breathing was not suppressed, but they also didn't feel the shock. So that was perfect. So clinically, the importance here is that we can now be very aggressive with painkillers without worrying so much that the breathing is going to get suppressed. So the number of individuals that die of an overdose of opiates in a clinical setting is very small. It happens when people are in chronic pain and they take home and they're having opiate patches and so forth. what this will allow the clinicians to do is not have to back off on the opiates and leave the patient in pain just to sustain their breathing. It'll also maybe minimize the amount that one has to ventilate the patient artificially, including babies, which is one of the focuses we have now. It's early days, but we're looking at other disease states where the breathing is suppressed during sleep, for instance, to see if the ampicline will act to juice up these times when the drive to breathe is weak in different stages. Mostly this happens during sleep, and to expand the use.
I understand that you're doing some clinical trials right now. What's involved in that?
Well, actually, the clinical trial was performed in Germany, and there was actually two of them, and they both gave the same result that it worked. Now, this is phase two clinical trial. Phase one is performed to show that the drug is safe. And then phase two is to show, especially 2A, which is the early one, is to show that, yes, the data from the basic science studies is holding up in the humans. So that's important. So now we have to go to much larger clinical trials. And this is where the stage we're at. But the pharmaceutical companies involved have to raise the money, and that's where things are at. But the rationale for moving forward based on not only the efficacy of these ampicillins for the purpose, but the commercialization could be quite significant. So we're confident that it's going to move forward when the money's raised.
Now, you've had quite a journey yourself from your aha moment with these drugs and having to actually turn this into, I guess, a business or to commercialize it. Tell me a little bit about that process for you.
Well, that's actually not so difficult at the University of Alberta because we have Tech Edmonton is the affiliate here. Their job is, if I come over to their office and say, look, I've just made this observation, it could be patentable, what do you think? Joanna Preston is my contact at Tech Edmonton, and we worked closely together for 3 or 4 years now. She contacted the individuals at Cortex Pharmaceuticals, set up all of the meetings. I went down to California, presented the data, and they've taken care of everything. Now, I do work closely with Cortex Pharmaceuticals now, testing different ampicillins to see which one's the best to move forward. I also spent a few days down with the CEO in New York, presenting the data to maybe 10 or 12 investing houses and showed them what the potential was to help raise money for clinical trials. I found that very interesting. As a scientist, we don't get to interact with that realm very often. And it was a real buzz. I enjoyed it. And I'm looking forward to do more of that. I'm trying to expand our translational work more and more and increase the commercialization, in part to bring money into the lab from pharmaceutical companies, because we can't depend on government money to fund everyone at this time. The funding levels are dropping all of the time. We've been fortunate and we maintain funding, but most of our funding goes to hiring personnel, technicians, graduate students, and postdocs. And I want to make sure that I have sufficient funding to cover their salaries and keep the momentum going and developing their careers and so forth. So I think we have to get more creative than just applying for grants from government agencies. But anyway, this work with Tech Edmonton and with Cortex Pharmaceuticals is not something that I envisioned 5 years ago, that's for sure. But now it's becoming quite a focus. And as I say, it's enjoyable and it's exciting.
Once the money's in place for this large trial, how many people will it involve?
Well, typically, I'm not an expert in clinical trials by any means, but I think we're talking about next phase two will be a larger one with a couple hundred people, and then it goes on from there to 3 and 4.
What else do you have on the go?
Oh, well, I have 3 or 4 different grants. The Ampicine project is the one that's resulting in these interviews, but I also look at other problems with the respiratory system. There are children born with holes in their diaphragm muscle, which leads to half of them die and the other half go on and have breathing problems throughout life, and we're trying to understand what happens, why there's this hole in the diaphragm in these certain kids. This happens in about 1 in 2,500 kids, so which is similar to cystic fibrosis, that's sort of what you've heard of, but this is called congenital diaphragmatic hernia. So our lab is recognized as being the lab that's sort of figuring out why these kids are born with this defect in their diaphragm muscle. We've identified some genes that might be involved, the vitamin A system. And again, that is being done. We're moving into measuring vitamin A levels in these children born with the disorder. Other projects, one thing that's happened is Tech Edmonton asked me to speak to the young professors who come to the University of Alberta and explain to them my experience, or describe my experience with being translational and getting involved in with industry. So I did that, and one of the young fellows came up to me and said that he's in the area of nanotechnology, which is very hot and very exciting, and he wanted to develop nanotechnology for detecting molecules in the blood or in the urine that were indicative of disease. And he has these nanostructures, and I have an expertise in measuring levels of different chemicals. So now we're teaming up, and actually we're going over to Tech Edmonton with some ideas soon. So this is a combination of his engineering and my biomedical research.
It sounds very exciting. Thank you very much, Dr. Greer.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.